everybody, this is Isaac, and you're listening to the intro for the Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture podcast. Today, we're going to have a special guest. That's right, returning champ, SMQ. You recall we talked about how we died in 2012, back in January 2018, right here on this podcast. You can check that show out. We talked about the Mandela Effect, which actually will bleed into today's show. Because today we're going to talk about Jack Parsons and some of the updates of the Mandela Effect. Now, there are some very curious elements that dropped out of this conversation. We're going to go into the idea of controlling reality. We go into how there are now works of art on the moon. Yes, Andy Warhol on the moon. Didn't know that, did you? I didn't know that. Find out why that is. Talk about science bleeding into chaos magic. Scientism as a global political system. And of course, Jack Parsons, who is the main topic of focus today. And we talk about how science was a tool for spirituality. And then we get into Parsons, the rocket scientist that, of course, was the predecessor for NASA. Talk about his upbringing and the beat movement, science fiction, and so on. With SMQ, who's actually very well versed in terms of scientific discussion, as you'll see. So can't wait to get into that. But I want to tell you that this show, this entire show, is available to you thanks to the Patreon subscribers. Patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher is where you can sign up. You'll get all the bonus content for all the shows. Free download of the ebook for The Dark Path. You can get it all, folks. And you could support me. Support the Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture podcast. This is a community, folks. Get on the mothership. 1,000 people can sign up for this thing. And then we're taking off. I don't know where we're going, but you get to help steer the ship. So yeah, sign up for that because those subscribers, those supporters are what keep this thing going, because Google and YouTube certainly are not available for me. They don't like my message. They want to pretend that I'm controversial hate speech, but if you've listened to me, you know that is not the truth. So what the hell is going on here? I also want to give a shout out to those that left some reviews on Amazon for The Dark Path. Much appreciated. Katie Bliss, Angie, big ups to you guys. But most of all, I don't want to put anyone out, but like Margaret left a review, and this one really touched me because the timing of this was very interesting, because I was actually having a couple days of back and forth in my mind of whether or not I should sort of continue this project, this Illuminati Watcher project, because I was worried that maybe I was giving too much of a voice to these occult doctrines. They call it the revelation of the method, and I've had some people say that I'm an agent for the revelation of the method. I am part of the Illuminati. Yes, that's it. That's what they say. And I thought, man, that's not what I want. Okay. I tried to provide a neutral place to present this information. I don't want to load it with emotion or tell you that it's wrong because I don't believe it to be the right path. Okay. The left-hand path is not the right path. That's what I think. But like, could I be wrong? Absolutely. It's just not for me. And I don't get into that too often. You know, I try not to espouse the Christian viewpoint too hard, because that turns a lot of people away. And I want people who are interested in these dark arts to come listen and then understand what they're getting into and then make the choice for themselves. Totally up to them. Okay. But Margaret left a review that, it touched me. And I want to thank you for that personally. It was very important that you dropped that when you did. I do believe in certain elements of synchronicity. That was a big deal to me. So anyways, that's enough of me yammering at you. Enjoy the show. This is SMQ. In January 2018, we talked about Mandela Effect and the controversial theory, did we die in 2012? And our guest, the returning champ, SMQ, is back. And we're going to talk a little bit about Mandela Effect, but we're going to focus on Jack Parsons. SMQ, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Isaac. How have you been doing?
Pretty good. I'm on the defenses against the Illuminati, apparently. They're shutting me down wherever they can. So Now I'm a true vigilante of sorts, apparently.
Well, the way I look at it is, you know, you must be over the target, man, because they are pulling you, and it makes no sense to me whatsoever, unless a lot of what you're saying is absolutely correct, and they don't want that to be acknowledged by other people, because otherwise all I see is a violation of your rights.
Yeah, it's crazy, because that's what I was talking to Sammy on Blackout Radio last week, or 2 weeks ago, and that was, you know, and it, it's tough because, like, from my perspective, I'm like, well, you know, I'm very rational and I don't know why they would do this to me. But, like, to hear other people also say, like, yeah, that doesn't really make sense. It pushes me down that path of believing all of this stuff to be true, because I've always kind of ridden in the gray zone of wondering, like, well, maybe it's not true, because I'm always kind of looking for this sort of, like, I don't know, scientific answer. But to me, the fact that they're shutting down certain people and certain voices, it kind of confirms that they're, if nothing else, trying to control reality and the official narrative of what is true.
Well, I think the most powerful thing, I did a little quick little, I don't know if you were able to hear, I did a quick little talk on my channel about you specifically, because it really bothered me. And what I said, you know, I'm kind of repeating this, is that it's more than just your content. It was your tone, your approach. You were very rational. You were not hateful. You didn't do any cheap shots. And a lot of what you did, if people just did their own homework, they could probably repeat exactly what you did. And by me saying that, it's a compliment, because it gives very little to the op-ed side of what a lot of channels mostly live off of. And, you know, mostly what you did was just pointing out things if people were to just observe those kinds of things. There was very little that you did that was made up. There was very little that you did that was your opinion, you know. So to me, it was startling, you know, and I think it has to do with this, they seem to come in waves, these crackdowns, and you were caught up in this larger, it's obviously Alex Jones is everywhere, but and to try to lump you in with Alex Jones is absurd, because nothing about, other than the fact that you're both carbon-based, you know, in humans, there's nothing about your approach that mirrors one another. So, you know, it really must mean that you're an outlier. And if that's the case, then you really, somewhere, some way, somehow, you really hit a nerve. And I think that's a good thing. It's a compliment to you, although it's a detriment to being able to grow your audience on YouTube for obvious reasons. But I think more or less it's kind of scary to me, because some of the things that you've pointed out were pretty dark and they were pretty, pretty terrifying. And if you're over the target, then I don't know what kind of world we really are in, actually, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, man. And thank you for that. It's quite kind of you, but yeah, that's what's concerning to me, because YouTube demonetized my channel about 2 years ago, meaning, like, I wasn't really making any ad money, and I had talked about that in the past, but the main reason for someone to go on YouTube and stay there is for the exposure, because there's just so much traffic there. Like, for instance, I've got, like, you know, I've got different avenues for people to connect, like through an email newsletter or Twitter or Facebook, but YouTube had, like, you know, 8 times the highest audience. I had almost 73,000 subscribers, I think it was, when they kicked me off. And to me, that's very strange. It's very strange. And like you said, it's almost terrifying a little bit to think that maybe all this kind of stuff we're looking at has more truth to it than the theories that I think I'm floating theories, but maybe there's, you know, some reality in it, which brings me to my first question for you. I wanted to ask you, speaking of realities and controlling them, what's new in the world of Mandela Effect since our last talk in January?
Big changes. I do a show called The Lost and Found Bin, and that's on Saturdays. You can come to my channel and check that out. And that's 2 o'clock East Coast. And there's a fellow YouTuber, her name is Chick, and that's the name of her channel as well. We both go sort of the pure ME route. There's very little that we deviate from. The show is purely about the Mandela effect and everything having to do with the Mandela effect. One of the biggest things is there are different groups out there that are starting to equate the Mandela effect and with other happenings, meaning, you know, sometimes in like the way I compare it, the financial market, in order to make a change to an instrument like a stock or an option or something like that, they want three or four identifiers to line up and to say, okay, this thing's about to go up or this is about to go down. But with the Mandela effect, one of the identifiers that are starting to be pretty consistent in terms of the shifts, the Mandela effect shifts, is the Schumann resonance. And every time there's a spike in the Schumann resonance, all of us that are MEs, we all notice the ringing of the ears. We notice the sometimes there's blurred vision. There's different kinds of Mandela changes in our personal lives. There's changes inside of us. There's changes in the people that are around us. So we think this is an ongoing process. We think the Mandela effect was not a one-time thing. It's a series of shifts. And every time there's a shift, and it's gotten to the point with Chick and the crew that she is and she's in contact with that is trying to put up different kinds of scientific indicators, they can almost predict when a shift happens. And sure enough, after a shift happens, we can see either geo changes or there'll be changes in history or there'll be modifications. And to even existing Mandela changes, you know, like the and there'll also be new waves of MEs is what we call them. If you're a Mandela affected person, we just call you an ME. We'll have new waves of videos of new MEs that have just discovered it. And we've come to the conclusion that you can't really see or be a part of the Mandela effect unless, you know, it happens to you. There's no proselytizing of this to someone. It has to, it's a very personal experience, you know, and I've relayed on my show some of the personal experiences as well as Chick and a lot of the other people that talk in ME circles, they're coming to that conclusion as well. And I'm not on Facebook, but I understand there's a lot of Facebook groups, private and public, that do their own kind of Mandela effect research, and a lot of which Chick is a part of. And yeah, we're starting to get some kind of predictive indicators of when a shift will happen. So big things on the ME front.
That's curious. So your show, Lost and Found Bin, focuses primarily on the ME community observations and so on. And if I heard you correctly, you're talking about the Schumann resonance, and these are kind of like physiological sort of effects that people are feeling in their bodies that suggest that there's been a shift or a shift occurring. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, it's changes in your body, changes in your outlook, your state of mind, changes in those around you. A lot of people say, you know, my spouse or my child is not the person I married or the person that I watched grow up. And oftentimes it's one of the going theories out there about that is that we are shifting to different versions of reality. There's a lot in quantum physics where they talk about a multiverse and different versions of reality. And that goes into talking about different things with superposition. And also too, a lot of us talk about being orphans of Sagittarius, and that's our position in sort of at the galactic level. And now we're in Orion's Spur. And before we were, you know, in the Sagittarius part of the universe. And it's very odd. All of it is very strange, and it's unfolding all the time. And for those of us that concentrate on it a whole lot, there's even been some sort of kind of interaction between the Mandela effect and ourselves in terms of it. I'm beginning to start to think that it's conscious and that it is watching us as much as we are watching it. There was a episode where Chick and I, we were starting to talk about the moon. And we were making observations about, maybe if we started talking about the moon and thinking about the moon, maybe changes will happen to the moon. And I think she or I or someone made a comment that maybe there'll be water parks on the moon before we know it. And by within a couple weeks from saying that, we had noticed, and obviously these things had already existed, but we had just noticed that there were plaques on the moon. There had been, there's art on the moon now. Andy Warhol is on the moon, some of his art at least. They took it up in one of the Apollo missions, and they've obviously found lunar water or what they think could be potentially water on the moon. And I know that they've discovered that on Mars as well. But the thing about the lunar water is that it came at a time when we were all concentrating on the moon itself. Now, that's not to say that we created that or we brought that into existence. When you're in the Mandela world, obviously all of those things exist, and then we find those things out later. So there's no proof that through like some kind of, you know, ritual circle, we all concentrated when and we were able to sort of change it, you know, existence itself. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that it's strange how the way in which you can direct your energy and concentration on something, that certain things that they come to light. And the strange thing about the Andy Warhol piece of this thing was that we all found out, and it's just like a half a page. You think this would be like a major thing. Mm-hmm. It's like half a page on Wikipedia of there was an Apollo mission, and this some character either in or outside of NASA was going around to the contemporary artists of the time, and he gave them a little tablet, like a little tiny, like, I don't know what kind of material it was, but he said, can you draw on this little, it's a couple inches by a couple inches, so we can send art up to the moon. And he did it to three or four different artists. And sure enough, they quote, smuggled the art on one of the missions. And it went up to the moon, and they put this on the moon. So there literally is an art installation with Andy Warhol on the moon now.
That's
and
weird.
And there are different... It's weird, right? It sounds weird, right?
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, you can wiki it. And the weird thing about these kinds of things that are so outlandish and so out there, you'll notice almost like those that program existence or the thing, it knows it's like on the hot seat, so it has to do it really fast. Hmm. So if you go look it up, something like this, you would think in pop culture this would have been an incredible moment where they would make movies about it. There would be endless documentaries about Andy Warhol being on the moon. No, we get half a page in Wiki. So it's very odd.
That is very weird. I've never heard that before. And not that I'm an expert on the moon. I do question the moon's existence in reality, because I have these arguments with people about, as far as I know, that scientists don't know how the moon got to where it is. They do know that it's an anomaly in our solar system, meaning like the moon for its size and location is peculiar for a natural satellite and its home planet. There's lots of weird things about the moon. So that's very curious that they've got a Warhol art piece up there. And I've never heard of that before. It's very strange. Now, a couple quick notes I want to add on to what you were saying there. You talked about like superposition and quantum mechanics. And I, in the last maybe 6 to 12 months, I've come to this is my new, I don't know, revelation, stream of consciousness, whatever, that these occultists that I've been studying for the last several years, I don't know that they're entirely wrong. And I've never sort of taken up sides on this battle. I've just, like you said earlier, I just kind of say, this is the belief system and here it is. And I'm not saying I'm pro occultist or anything like that, but what I am saying is these belief systems that the occultists have, that they've had for hundreds of years, they share the same understanding that some of these quantum physicists have come to with these seemingly very odd, weird ideas like superposition. A lot of people dismiss concepts of like magic or entities or other dimensions, but what they don't understand is that these scientists in the labs and these theoretical physicians and stuff, they're all sort of proving this stuff to be true, and creating and manifesting your own reality through thoughts is, you know, and I don't know, obviously I don't know how to like do that per se, but like, kind of like you said, how you guys were talking about the water parks on the moon, and then sure enough, now there's water on the moon. There's something to be said for mental emanations and the universe kind of like jiving with that, which ties very nicely into today's topic, because
and if I can add to that for just 1 second,
yeah,
I think the problem that, and we've talked about this too on the show, the biggest issue we deal with now is that incredibly informed and well-educated people are absolutely ignorant to the bleeding edge of science. Science itself is sort of shading itself into chaos magic. It yeah. truly is. And if you dismiss magic and you're a complete an arch materialist, a complete reductivist, what you're doing is you're just not keeping up with what the latest science is telling you. The latest science is actually telling you, it is literally telling you that magic is real, chaos magic is real, and that the way in which that we, you know, some of the basic tenets of magic is, you know, intention, directing energy, concentration, you know, the double slit experiment is proof positive of all of those things. You know, something doesn't exist until you as a human entity concentrate on it, and then you bring it into existence, and then there's a moment where there's enough energy and there's enough time where you could actually mold or shape physical matter, you know, into existence, and you can also change it. Mm. And you know, that's the science, and that's where the science is actually going. So for to be an arch materialist and then to actually dismiss magic or to dismiss any kind of faith or religion, you're just not keeping up with where real science is at. That's all it is. You're still in sort of a kind of 90s state of mind of being an atheist, saying this is it, this is all there is. It's sort of like, you know, you're just out of step and out of touch. I mean, they have things like the Boltzmann brain now, where they think that self-aware entities that are just straight up brains are forming, you know, inside of this vast empty universe. Seriously, just it gets weirder and weirder the deeper you look into science and the problems of the multiverse, theories about quantum immortality, all of these things. And I think the biggest problem why they're putting the white papers out on this kind of science, but they're not really promoting it, is immediately the average person like you and I, they're immediately going to go back to their original corners of a faith. Like if you were inclined to be a Christian, you're immediately probably going to go back to that. Now, why a scientist would care or not, I could see could be maybe a matter of funding. It could be a matter of politics. It could be three or four other very unmagical, just very kind of nuts and bolts way in which the politics of science works. But it also, too, unfortunately, it exposes that science and scientism is, one, a belief system, and two, it's actually a political system. And it's the dominant political system that we have on Earth right now. Mm-hmm. There's no communism, there's no capitalism, it's scientism. And that is the dominant system that actually steers countries in the way in which they see their resources, in the way in which they see their technology, in the way that they kind of handle their citizens. So very much so, these kinds of things need to be under wrap, because you could see a reshuffling of the geopolitical situation overnight if people really began to grasp and understand exactly what's going on in the cutting edge of science today.
That's funny, because I was having a conversation today with someone about how there's different kind of decisions I've made in, you know, like in my personal life or whatever, where I found myself trying to find the right answer through some kind of logic or scientific study or observation. And the more I take a step back and think about the big picture of like reality and why we're here, I think, you know, these scientists and these studies and these facts, I mean, I don't know. I think part of me thinks that people want to know someone's in control and that there's an answer for everything. So politicians and some scientists, they do observations and try to find an answer, and to the best of their knowledge, they give an answer. But we, on the other side of that, try to make it a definite answer. And the example that I give when I talk to people about this kind of thing is like, this is why science can be wrong, is because of like nutrition. Like, is it good or bad to drink milk? It changes every week. We don't know.
Yes.
And like, there's no crystal clear answer as to what the best diet is to lose weight or whatever. they just don't know the answers. And not to say and that they're just wrong or shouldn't be involved, but there's a non-logical way of looking at the world that is discounted, quite frankly. And that's exactly what you're saying, is like our world is scientism.
And you just put the dagger in the heart of it right there. What you just said is exactly what they want to avoid, and that they don't have the answers. And that's the whole point of sort of the scientific method and the authority from which scientists, and also the sort of authority that those that believe in scientism, that they're able to derive, and the condescension in their tone and everything about it. And yet, if you were to take a science book from the 1980s, a science book from the 1960s, a science book on any kind of science from the 1920s, none of them are going to resemble one another. And like you just said, you just hit it. You went to the core. You went right to the core of it. They just don't know. And here's the thing. And we didn't set this up, everyone. This dovetails perfectly with Parsons, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Because Parsons, he had what I think. Now, look, before I say this, you can agree on whether or not the OTO, or whether or not, you know, Parsons' brand of his faith is correct or not. What I'm trying to say, and we can argue that in a minute, what I'm trying to say is he was taking equal parts science and equal parts of faith and equal parts of the magical realm or the spiritual realm. He was so far, he was more than 100 years ahead of his time as far as I can tell with that, because all of us had to go from, at his time, everything was just about faith and science really, in terms of it being in the subconscious of the average American, really wasn't there. Now, in the average American, there still is a lot of faith and all of those things, but it's really relegated to something that can be ridiculed. And that if you're just superstitious, you're uneducated, you know, you're a redneck, you know, name all the derogatory things you want about someone, the classic person who's a person of faith, and generally in America, that will be a Christian. Now, Jack Parsons, it was almost as if he could see through all of that, being a member of the OTO, which is Crowley's organization, and being a leader of the Agape Lodge of California, and particularly Pasadena. Actually, it is just Pasadena, the Agape Lodge. But being a leader of that, you know, he was one of the first ones that I can tell that's really popular that was taking equal parts of those two things and being able to reconcile in a modern way both the science side and both the spiritual side. And what made him extra special and what made him really sort of the spooky model, whether scientists like it or not, he was actually letting the spiritual side be the dominant side. It was science that was sort of the addendum to the whole thing. It was science that was adding to the spiritual side. Science, so, you know, the way in which he got his ideas, the way in which he wanted to forward things, that was spirituality. Science to him was only a tool. Science wasn't the faith. His faith was his brand of spirituality. And again, like I said, you can argue about, and that's fine, about his faith and his spirituality. The point is, even if he was right, and let's say you want to call him an arch-Satanist, that still forged the argument for a lot of Christians.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you, actually, was why? Because I've had this when I talk to people in my sort of day-to-day life. I'll mention the name Jack Parsons, and I would say 9 out of 10 times people say, "Who is that?" And yeah, for some reason, people have no clue who he is, because he's, for one reason or another, isn't on the forefront of history. But I was going to ask you, why is he so important? Because his name comes up so often when you research these sort of, I don't know, supernatural, occult sciences sort of ideas. He's a very important figure in terms of that kind of stuff, and saying that he basically was using science as a tool for spirituality. That's, I think you nailed it on the head, man. I think that's a pretty accurate overall statement of why he's important.
Yeah. And he's also incredibly, incredibly dangerous. And he's probably in the top 10 most influential and important figures of the 20th century. I mean, he easily is as big as, for better or for worse, FDR, Stalin, Adolf Hitler. I mean, he's up there, man. He is a major figure. And the reason why he's a major figure, and obviously I'm not you know, promoting any of those people that I just said. My point about these mega figures is they changed this world forever, and in a way that we can never go back.
Hi everybody, this is your host Isaac Weishaupt, and I want to talk to you today about The Dark Path. It's my latest book. And if you ever wondered what exactly is going on in society today, why are things so strange, why is there symbolism hidden in our entertainment, then you got to read The Dark Path. Aleister Crowley once said, "In this aeon, the emphasis is on the self or will, not on anything external such as gods or priests." And I believe he correctly predicted the future in what he calls the Aeon of Horus. Given today's narcissistic tendencies of social media, I believe that they have infiltrated our entertainment to brainwash the masses. Now, this book is a result of many years of delving into the recesses of occult dogma and approaching it with open-minded rationalism. As you know, my journey started by looking to separate religion from conspiracy theories. But after all this research, there is a clear agenda and connection between the two. So the question to be considered is if this agenda of the Illuminati overlaps with the tenets of the occult, or whether or not there is actually evil influence at play here. Using cited references to occult literature from the likes of Aleister Crowley, Helena Blavatsky, Kenneth Grant, Jack Parsons, and Alice Bailey, I provide a fundamental exploration of the occult belief system and their alternate version of history. I utilize familiar examples from pop culture, film, music, television, to provide the symbolism analysis that the Illuminati agenda speaks to. They are trying to steer humanity down the path of Luciferianism, which speaks to our subconscious mind. The demonstration of occult symbols, predictive programming, and ritual magic concepts will be evident as you read about the connections between Disney, The Beatles, Star Wars, Rihanna, Led Zeppelin, Jay-Z, Katy Perry, Westworld, Harry Potter, Rocky Horror Picture Show, alien films, Batman, Ancient Aliens, comic books, superheroes, and so much more. This work carves out a distinction between the witches, Satanists, magicians, occultists, and the New Age, while proving connected desires to usher in Crowley's Aeon of Horus as the New World Order. Using concepts from Gnosticism, Freemasonry, alchemy, Kabbalah, and ceremonial magic, I explain the Hermetic axioms such as as above, so below, which so many of these occultists subscribe to, with mental emanations used to create reality. It's all part of the evolution of consciousness being used to push mankind down the path of obliteration through transhumanism, which promises an alchemical pursuit of immortality. NASA, Adolf Hitler's Nazis, the ancient alien theorists, they're all using Darwin's theory of evolution to assert the superiority of alien life forms. This is, of course, coordinated through the efforts of science fiction, which shows us beliefs of making direct contact with these demonic deceptions. The unsuspecting masses will be shocked to find out that the Illuminati savior of Lucifer and his desire to put us into the transhuman digital matrix ultimately destroys God's creation by evolving us into the next entity, a globally connected digital form of consciousness. Now, if you want to read this book, I suggest you go to Amazon or Audible. You can read. There's over 100 positive reviews on this thing. Check them out on Amazon or Audible. And, of course, Audible is the audiobook platform, which you can get to either through Amazon or audible.com. And if you sign up for a free trial membership, you can get this book for free. That's right. Absolutely free. And I narrated it myself, so I take great pride in that. So check it out. You can get it however you desire, Amazon, Kindle, or paperbacks, even on my Gumroad store, gumroad.com/IsaacW. I've got signed paperbacks I'll ship to your house. And of course, there's an option to join the team on patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher, where you'll get access to all my bonus podcast content and a free ebook download of The Dark Path. So choose whatever path you desire, but always stay true to your path.
And there was a before each person I mentioned, and then there's an after. And Jack Parsons is one of those. And the thing about Jack Parsons, what makes it even worse about Jack Parsons in terms of if you want to list the great scientists of the 20th century, is he was not an atheist. He was not an arch materialist. He was someone who only used science as something, as just like any other tool that he would use, like a sigil or like any kind of magical working. And you know, if for anyone that doesn't know, Jack Parsons, the reason why he's so important is that he was one of the first rocket scientists out there. He was one of the first people to actually take things from the science fiction page and turn them into science fact. And the most important contribution that we still use to this very day is that he was one of the most important figures to create solid rocket fuel. And the importance of solid rocket fuel is basically the cornerstone of rocketry. So he is the arch rocket scientist that is out there. And without rockets, you don't have satellites. You don't have, it's almost, you don't have NASA. You don't have the space shuttle. You don't have the space race. You have none of those things. And you certainly don't have nuclear weapons that can go intercontinental like that. So that's why he is so important, because he created a technology that is sort of underlying all kinds of technologies that we use today and we take for granted. You know, I know a lot of people nowadays, they question whether or not satellites exist or any of those things. But let's just, for hypothetical, let's say satellites do exist. The Earth is round. Everything is exactly like they said it was. You know, even so, they're giving up the territory that this guy who was just an avowed hardcore occultist, he was able to use through occultism and a sprinkling of science. He was able to use those tools to change the world in a dramatic way that no one to this day is really wrapping their heads around. And that's what makes him so dangerous, and that's why people don't like to talk to him. And I think only now, in this climate, where one, everything is so wide open, and two, there's sort of a resurgence of the occult. There's a resurgence in alternative religions, that it's actually kind of safe. And I think a lot of scientism, particularly the real scientists that are on the cutting edge, they see the writing on the wall. And, you know, you better get a figure out in front of this thing. Because once this starts becoming more and more mainstream, and it's something that you can't hold back because there's so much information out there, that this guy, you know, even if you're a Christian, you can take solace in the fact that this guy proved demons. This guy proved a dark side, you know. Or if you're a New Age or you're a cultist, you know, you could say this guy proved that there are ways in which to, you know, raise your vibrations and, you know, all of those things that we've heard before. He was experimenting with all of those things. And the great thing is he has something that no one can deny to show for it.
Yeah, he was into a lot of these occult studies. And I haven't compiled the list yet. But when I read through Wormwood Star, it's a book about Marjorie Cameron. Jack Parsons takes up a healthy chunk of it, because he's the one who obviously brought Cameron into these ideas of occult philosophy. He also had some level of influence on L. Ron Hubbard, who used many of these ideas in his Church of Scientology.
And the thing about Parsons is, you know, sort of Parsons' world was like this. He was, you know, his parents separated very early on when he was a kid. He lived a upper middle class lifestyle. It was called, I think, Millionaire's Mile, in a basically a mansion in Pasadena. And he didn't really, for the most part of the early part of his life into adulthood, money was not a problem for him. That gave him, and because he was incredibly inquisitive and off the charts intelligent that gave him a lot of time to sort of dream and to read and to explore. And so eventually what happened was that mansion became what they call the parsonage, where he actually put out a local, you know, back then you would send to newspapers in the private sections or the classifieds, hey, I'm looking for X, Y, and Z. And I'm paraphrasing, but for the most part, he said he was looking for scientists, atheists, artists, mystics, occult people, you know, anything like that. A very strange kind of mixture, and that he was renting out rooms in this mansion that he lived in so he could get that sort of atmosphere inside of, you know, his mansion in Millionaire's Row. So from early on, he was someone that liked to kind of mix up the company, so to speak, because if you have an arch atheist and then you have an occultist, you know, that to sort of make a bridge between those two, even today, is pretty hard to do. And he did that in real life. And then to take something like the OTO and take a budding thing in science that's really at that point was really just science fiction, which is basically rocketry. And he was a guy that was able to marry a lot of things that even to this day, average minds like myself, it still makes it very difficult for me to see how he did it. And that's sort of the atmosphere that he cultivated. And that's how he's able to tie an L. Ron Hubbard, a Marjorie Cameron, Crowley, you know, over and over again, these disparate figures with disparate interests and backgrounds that don't seem to over, you know, to cross over at all. He's able to take these kinds of figures and bring them all together. And, you know, I've taken a writing class before in school, and I know that what they talked about was contrast, contrast, contrast. And that's sort of what he did in life. You know, he took a 101 college course and he applied it to life. And that's what he did.
Hmm. Yeah, speaking of that parsonage house, well, first off, to talk about his upbringing, that sounds very Crowley-ish, growing up with you know, a wealthy family or whatever, and having time to sort of think through some of these deeper thoughts on reality. But in the book, the Wormwood Star book, they had a section where they were talking about the director, Curtis Harrington, who did a movie called Night Tide that Marjorie Cameron was in, along mm-hmm. with Dennis Hopper. There's a quote in there, and it says, "I know of a certain house in Pasadena where they have secret satanic rites, and you have to go up into an attic, and then they close the trap door, and you can't get out." And later it kind of postulates that was Parsons' house, the parsonage that you're talking about. Because
absolutely,
you know, and that's where to most people, because I guess there's got to be a certain level of reading this sort of material over and over to distinguish between what does it mean to be satanic. And like you said, he was bringing in a variety of guests, a sort of eclectic group of people who weren't on the sort of straight and narrow formal you know, the middle class at that time, because to me, you know, he was part of sort of like the beatnik movement. And the beatnik movement of the 50s is what gave us the hippie movement of the 60s. And then even in this book, they talk about how important the beatnik move was for pushing Aleister Crowley's Aeon of Horus ideas.
He's sort of the invisible glue that no one puts together. I'm a huge fan of Henry Miller. Therefore, I read like Delta of Venus of Ennis Nin. And if you read
Ennis Nin is in that book. If you haven't read Wormwood Star, Ennis Nin shows up several times.
Okay, great. And that's just it, because I think they were in a couple movies together, not just Harrington. I think they were in what's the other director with Hollywood Kenneth Babylon? Anger. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I think they've been in at least one or two movies together, and I don't know if it was Harrington and Anger or just Harrington or just Anger, but they had been in movies together. So there was the influence of Ennis Nin and Miller in there, as well as Cameron. And people have to understand, when you talk about the Beat Generation, who they, one of the people that they mentioned, particularly like Kerouac and I believe even Burroughs, which by the way were the forefathers of the Beatnik Generation, they talked about it was Henry Miller. So you see that tie from Henry Miller and Anais Nin together on and off as a couple for a very long time. And then you see that, you know, Anais Nin and Cameron are together and they're doing sort of these artistic explorations on film. And you have a person like Parsons where you can't just say, well, he was just the rocket science guy that was actually with Cameron and it's all just a coincidence. No, Parsons very much cultivated the atmosphere of creativity. And in fact, he was very open about, you know, getting in a creative, particularly sci-fi, which was very vanguardish at the time. And it was very dangerous at the time. And people were very uncomfortable and found it really repulsive, science fiction at the time, which we can't even imagine now. Because we've now been engulfed in that fiction. And I think he could see that you could take a fiction, apply just a right amount of magic or energy or whatever mojo that he wanted to apply to it, and you could bring that into being and make that sort of live rent-free in people's heads. And you can, you know, he was sort of the source of all of those things. And then once you get into that, you start seeing, okay, it started to take off with, you know, the early Beat Generation, then it went into the hippies, and then you basically have the second half of the 20th century. And by the time these characters come along, like Leary and, you know, all these other, the usual suspects come around, you know, there were people setting this up and really pulling this whole cloth out of nothing. And Jack Parsons, he's one of those core people. And I would probably go on a limb to say he's probably, now this is pure speculation, so that's all I'm saying, and I'm just thinking out loud here. He could probably be one of the main bridges of tying how you would tie a Crowley to a William Burroughs or Crowley to popular culture of the 1960s and onwards. You know, he was in direct contact with Crowley. He was running, you know, his lodge of the OTO at the time when he was coming into contact with people, you know, like Cameron, which would come into contact with Nin. And then you have over and over again these characters. And it's really kind of digging to that second layer that most people don't, because they just think, you know, these figures just landed on the earth like Leary and all these people, fully baked and done, and they knew Crowleyism, and, you know, they were all Thelemites, and they knew right away exactly what to do, and they knew their places. That, no, there was, you had to take bridges from, you think of Crowley, I mean, he was during the time of, you know, when the British Empire was still a powerful empire, and he could use those sort of lines to kind of travel around the world. Then suddenly there's this gap, sort of, and then you have William Burroughs and Kerouac, and you have the hippies and all that. Well, the middle people during all that time would be like a Parsons. It would be like a Henry Miller, Anais Nin, Marjorie Cameron. That's really your one of the major bridges for all of these kinds of things. And it's really that kind of thinking, the marrying of and the beginning that early on, way ahead of all of us getting to it, going, wow, there really can be something to this magical thinking and tying it to science. And indeed, can we use the magical thinking to actually not just influence the science, but actually drive the science? And science is the vehicle. Science is the tool. I mean, that inversion of thinking that happened to me, not that I do that, but in terms of me going, wow, this is really the way they thought. It shook me up. I'd never, because I was brought up kind of in a new agey kind of materialist environment. And then it went more into materialism and atheism as I got, you know, into my 20s. And then after that, it started to crumble as I started to get into this kinds of stuff and started to research these kinds of things. And I realized, no, there's a thread that goes all the way through that knew that science was the tool and that the occult was the actual driver of that tool.
Mm. That's some heavy stuff, man. Yeah, the whole idea that the 20th century has these group of sort of unsung heroes. I mean, I use heroes in quotes, depending on your viewpoint of, how people want to take their sides on this discussion. These sort of unsung people that, William Burroughs, who had influence on Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. And I was reading in this book about how Naked Lunch was actually a book that was banned in America for a while for obscenity. And it was a quote, magical realist work. And when they lifted the ban on it, it sort of ushered in this, conscious, change in the consciousness in America, and these beat writers and this beat subculture paved the way for the 60s. And, talking about people that were influenced by all this, Charles Manson, he always said that he was not a hippie. He was a part of the beat culture.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of big figures that it's like this glaring hole in history. Cause if you ask people about, who was influential before the 70s, and they're going to tell you the Beatles and Elvis Presley,
Right.
but there's so much more to it. Like you said, they kind of changed and molded the minds of the masses, but the people take a long time to absorb this stuff. And it took probably 60, 70 years for it to finally kind of sink in.
Yeah. And if you think about it, you talk about William Burroughs and his being banned. Henry Miller, decades before Burroughs, I think it was in the 30s when he went through his trial, his obscenity trial. Mm-hmm. And Henry Miller, he fled to Paris. And, Henry Miller, he was right there with all of them. And obviously his torrid love affair, with Anaïs Nin and all that, which obviously again links us to Cameron and anger and all the core figures. But yeah, and the beat writers, they took cues from Henry Miller. Henry Miller would oftentimes, he had books on writing, and he would oftentimes talk about meditations and going into those kinds of things. And the way in which Henry Miller is portrayed by the mainstream versus what Henry Miller actually says, he comes off as a straight up mystic. He straight up, it's not something that he really hides. And his book, his seminal book, Tropic of Cancer, I mean, that in itself, you can almost sense this guy is scribing, and he's absolutely going in and out of consciousness. The book even reads that way. And yet books like that and Black Spring and all the others, they read smoothly, and they give you a kind of, if you could take books and turn them into abstract paintings, that's exactly what you were dealing with early figures that no one really talks about, like Henry Miller. And Henry Miller, I mean, I know the way he's portrayed versus what I read, and he's dancing around some pretty mystical stuff. And again, all of this is, these people are all dancing around like the same areas and in the same circles, and they all cross over in these different ways, and it's very powerful stuff.
Absolutely. And what I do want to ask you, because I'm down to about 10 minutes here.
Okay.
One of Parsons' more infamous things that he took a part of was the Babylon Working. And yes. I've read different interpretations of what this was supposed to do. And what do you think about the Babylon Working? Maybe give a brief sort of description of what it was for people who are still curious as to who Jack Parsons is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a typical idea of having like a star child. And the idea of bringing in they wanted to bring in a star child or that star child would bring about great change in the world. And I can't remember if they were talking about the actual Armageddon or just these great changes with the working, but they thought at the time the working failed. And, some people still argue the red haired, harlot was actually Cameron herself, because she showed up on their doorstep with red hair. Shortly after. So you know, was it a success? Was it not? Because she ended up becoming pregnant, and I don't think she obviously didn't have the baby. I think something went wrong, and they didn't, and she wasn't able to have the baby. But the idea was to have this child, and the child would bring about, you know, either end times or a change in awareness or whatever it was. But it didn't work. But a lot of people talk about, well, we don't know, actually. I mean, if you think about it, they did the Babylon working. Allegedly, perhaps a lot of people think it didn't work. But then you look at the way in which the first half of the 20th century is portrayed in America versus the second half and into the 21st century. And then you think of the leap in technology, and then you think in the leap into the perception, and the generations that are directly behind that. Perhaps it was. And just because we don't have a figure that's easily accessible to, you know, people who don't do the research, doesn't mean that it was not successful, you know. But a lot of people also say that particular working gave birth to the UFO era, and that they actually ripped a hole in reality, and the way someone put it is a UFO flew through. And right after that was one of the first UFO spottings. So it's, you know, the Babylon working, did it work? Didn't it work? I don't know. I just know that they had it, and then a lot of strange things happened afterwards. And I know that she showed up, and it was very strange. And then he died under very suspicious circumstance. You know, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, some people claim that Parsons even faked his own death. And I watched a movie that was kind of a sort of fictional movie called the I don't remember, The Moon to Moo or something like that, The Ride to Moo. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever heard of that. It's kind of a out there movie. It was made in like 2008, and it spliced together a bunch of various clips about Parsons and Cameron. But anyways, in the book that I read, it said that the Babylon working had multiple interpretations, and Cameron, the one idea is that this Agape Lodge, this inner circle that was there, they thought that the Babylon working was meant to result in this actual physical birthing, just like you said, you know, but
yeah,
the baby thing didn't work out, and that Jack was going to create this moon child, this magical offspring between him and Marjorie Cameron, which would yes. be imbued with Babylon spirit from this astral plane. But what was curious, what I had read in the book, was that she claimed that she saw Jack Parsons writing to Aleister Crowley that there would be a secret sign. And she remembers seeing a cigar-shaped UFO when she was with Jack Parsons while he was still alive. And said that Jack had drawn this UFO with a circle, with a triangle. And anyways, but there's other ideas that the Babylon working was just symbolic, and it was this metaphysical exploration to bring about the changing times and to wake up the inner libido of the masses, which we could argue did or did not happen. Like I said, we don't know, but for sure that was a pretty dynamic time in history in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s. That was a pretty drastic change in society.
Yeah. And if you think about it, you know, right after that, what if you take just the decades after that, you have the internet, you have it just goes over and over and over again. In a lot of ways, with the way in which they talk about Babylon, and, you know, and just because they talk about Armageddon, it doesn't necessarily, it just means an unveiling. And if you think about it, the way in which the internet works, there was a great unveiling there. You know, and if you were to look at that, you know, the way that it's like what I talk about with the Mandela effect. The Mandela effect only exists today because of the internet, because you can get someone in Wichita talking with someone in Brooklyn, and they can talk about a shared experience that they had, and they're thousands of miles from each other, and there's no way under normal social circumstances that they could ever speak with one another. Now, that is a tool. The internet is a tool on this plane of existence that was a great awakening, if you think of it that way. So was that, you know, a direct correlation to the Babylon working? Was that a direct correlation to anything that the OTO did? I can't say definitely. I just know that they did a lot of workings, including Crowley, who was famous for not finishing his workings, or I should say infamous. And all I know is that they did a lot of things in terms of specific magical rituals and rites, and particularly where they did them at seems to be the seeds from which a lot of things were planted. And it's almost as if you have to use science as a way in which, as a translator, as a legend, in order to translate to regular people so they can understand what's happening. And that science itself is really just the mask that magic wears. So people can feel better about what they're taking part in, and so people can feel better about what they're experiencing and what they're witnessing. Because if you were to remove all the scientific language about things like rockets and what they're capable of doing, and remove all the language of what the internet's capable of doing, you absolutely would think that it's a work of witchcraft, and a lot of people would think that it's a work of evil because of the way in which you can uncover things, the way in which you really can't hide anymore, the way in which people that are, you know, disparate socially or economically or any other way that you want to put it, they're able to talk to one another. And also, too, a lot of it has to do with empowering the individual. So the individual has no one else to blame but themselves for the circumstances they find themselves in spiritually, particularly spiritually.
When you talk about the internet being created, and again, we're talking about this, science is what led us to the internet. And the internet, I think, is part of the sort of end game to create this idea of a global consciousness, because if everyone uploads their mind as a digital consciousness into this internet, then that's in effect what we get, is a global consciousness where everyone is in fact connected. But first they've got to sort of crack the code of the human mind, or what they best believe it will be. So Jack Parsons could very well have been the guy who got this whole thing kick-started.
Absolutely. And, you know, everything about the way in which any, and that's the other thing too, the core from which NASA was created, the core from which JPL was created, the core from which, you know, the internet was created, all of these things, they all have occult basis to them. Everything about them is shrouded in the occult. Everything, you know, you just like ARPANET and why I just pulled up the history of the internet. I believe it was, The day that it was invented, or the day that it was unveiled, was some sort of magical day itself. I'm thinking it's April 30th, which is a pretty significant. Yeah, yeah.
Al Gore did it.
Yeah, right, exactly. And that was another thing about an ME, about how the internet was created and who created it. I always thought it was ARPANET, and I knew it was DARPA and all that, but I didn't know CERN had anything to do with it. Now apparently CERN has something to do with it.
Oh, is that
and
so?
I knew it was an ARPANET. Yeah, yeah. And I knew it was DARPA. I knew it was ARPANET. I knew that those particularly research institutes inside of Stanford had a lot to do with it, but I didn't know, apparently. I heard that CERN was also a part of that.
I haven't looked it up in a long time, but when I went to school, I took a course on information technology, and what I recall was that there was the government-funded programs, and I thought it was like between Boston and maybe California Stanford, and somewhere in the Northeast, where they were trying to find a way to transfer data. And that's how the internet was born, through government funded projects like that. But CERN, that's like an international organization, right?
Well, and I took a course on the history of the internet. I actually took a college course on that. What bothers me is that I passed the course based off the fact that it's basically what you just said, that the military needed a way to simultaneously share information between the East Coast, specifically Boston, and the West Coast. In order to do that, what they wanted to be able to do was simultaneously share data in the event that there is a launch, whether nuclear or otherwise, on, you know, the soil of the U.S. That's what I was always taught. Mm-hmm. But apparently now they wanted to, or my understanding is that CERN wanted to simultaneously share information about their particle smashers as early as the 1950s, and they wanted to be able to do it internationally. So it's very confusing to me.
That is. Well, you know, we could talk all day on this stuff. But I'm running out of time here. I want you to tell the guests the best place to find you and your show, your new show that you've got, you know, your social media feeds, however, the best way to find you.
Oh, thanks. On Twitter, I'm at AI_SMQ. And then the opposite of that, which apparently a lot of people think is a Mandela effect, and I really can't argue with them. You can find me on YouTube, and you can just search SMQ space AI, or you can look for like SMQ Mandela effect, and then you can find me there. But it's SMQ space AI, and it's with myself and Chick with the Lost and Found Bin. We did 18 episodes, and we're going to do the 19th episode coming up here this weekend. But I also do my own stuff as well. That's just once a week, and I try to catch a Sunday show. I dropped off for a few weeks because I had a project that I had to do. And that's over now, so I'm able to get back to my regular Sunday night shows. But the Lost and Found Bin Saturdays, that's 2:00 Eastern. And, you know, come on in and check it out. It's just 1 hour long. And that's, if you want to get a hold of me, that's the best way to do it. And I do respond the best on Twitter. That's the best way to immediately get a hold of me.
Okay, great. And I'll post links on the show notes on IlluminatiWatcher.com. But hey, man, I want to thank you again for coming back on your first show with me, the We Died in 2012 show. That was one of the most popular shows I've got. In fact, on YouTube, prior to the big banning, I believe it was your show that had the most views out of all my my podcast videos that I had. So kudos and thank you for that. That's awesome. People are very interested in this topic, and again, I'll post all of your social media links to your show on the show notes. So thanks again.
Well, I appreciate you having me, and anytime you want to talk really cool stuff about Parsons or any characters like that, I'm totally down with it. So you call and I'll answer.
Excellent. All right, thank you much. All right, that was the show. What do you think? Subscribe to the Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture podcast. It's on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, Spotify. It's wherever you want it to be. Subscribe and leave some comments. Leave some reviews. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. I already know you don't like it when I limit the content of the show, but hey, that's the hand I've been dealt. And if you want all the content, if you want the whole truth, nothing but the truth, go to patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher and you can be a proud supporter of the show. That's patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher. Thank you for your time. As always, be your best for those who deserve your best.